This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Scott Ritter, is at the center of an ongoing controversy about the former UN weapons inspection program in Iraq and its relationships with international intelligence agencies, including the CIA. Ritter was a chief inspector with UNSCOM, the UN Special Commission that was created by the Security Council in April of 91 after the Gulf War. When the war ended, Iraq was required to submit to the UN an inventory of its total stockpile of biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, weapons components, and their means of production. UNSCOM's mission was to verify the Iraqi declaration and oversee the destruction or removal of all weapons of mass destruction. Ritter was the head of the UNSCOM team that investigated Iraq's system of concealing weapons. He resigned last August, saying the Clinton administration was undermining UNSCOM's work. UNSCOM stopped its inspections in mid-December when Iraq's refusal to cooperate led the U.S. and Britain to bomb Iraq. Scott Ritter has written a new book called Endgame. I asked him to describe his work as head of UNSCOM's Concealment Investigations Unit.
My responsibility was going after Iraq's concealment mechanism, that is, the organizations and the techniques used by Iraq to hide weapons of mass destruction from the weapons inspectors. Other inspectors were worried about more technical issues such as ballistic missiles, chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, export-import monitoring. I was looking at it from a much broader perspective, how Iraq was obstructing the work of the Special Commission, how Iraq was hiding all materials. Mine was a multidisciplinary approach. Now, the Iraqis chose, from the very start, not to submit a complete declaration. And furthermore, they...
A declaration of what weapons they really had in stock.
That's right. The declaration they were obligated to submit under the provisions of Security Council resolution listing the totality of their weapons of mass destruction holdings. They opted from the very beginning to deny the existence, for instance, of their entire biological weapons programs, to deny the existence of their entire nuclear weapons programs, to deny the existence of an indigenous capability to produce ballistic missiles, and to deny much of their chemical weapons production capability. It was just an outright lie. Now, in addition to lying and submitting a false declaration, the Iraqis tasked the same organizations, the same personnel who are responsible for presidential security, that is, the people responsible for the safety of Saddam Hussein, were also given the task of safeguarding these prohibited materials that were being retained for building this concealment mechanism. Now, these aren't rocket scientists that we're talking about. We're talking about thugs, brutal thugs, people whose lives are dedicated to serving Saddam Hussein and protecting Saddam Hussein. They were now tasked with protecting these weapons of mass destruction. This is a brutal dictatorship that we're talking about, a regime of terror, and they don't come by this reputation lightly. These people intimidate for a living. And when weapons inspectors come into Iraq to hunt down these weapons that were charged with doing by the Security Council, these people not only hide the weapons, but they seek to intimidate the weapons inspectors.
Give me an example of a good intimidation tactic that they would use to get you to back down, or to try to get you to back down.
Well, when we go into Iraq, we're unarmed. Our strength comes from the legitimacy given to us by the Security Council and the fact that the world body is united in backing up the work of the inspectors. But when you arrive at a site and you're suddenly confronted with military personnel carrying machine guns who load the weapons and point them at you with their finger on the trigger, saying if you proceed, they will kill you, that's a fairly effective form of intimidation.
Did you want to intimidate them back? Did you want to out-intimidate them so that they wouldn't get you to back down?
It's not a question of out-intimidate them. Our job was not to go in there and intimidate anybody. Our job wasn't to go in there and be bullies. Our job was to carry out weapons inspections. But let's understand one thing. When I put a team together to go into Iraq, I'm putting a team together of personnel who have never worked with each other before. It's not as though I'm bringing in a Marine Corps rifle company that has trained with one another for years and is a cohesive unit. I'm bringing in scientists from around the world, scientists who have spent the bulk of their life behind a desk, not in the field. I'm bringing in computer specialists who will carry out specific inspections on computers. But again, these are personnel who haven't worked with the scientists we're bringing in. I bring in linguists. I bring in security personnel, specialists, people who have a team of about 40 to 50 people who have never worked with one another before and are now in this new environment. They're not there representing their governments. They're representing this thing called the United Nations Special Commission. I train them on the technical aspects of their job. We're going to get you to Site A, and computer specialists, we're going to put you on a computer, and you're going to turn it on. And if the Iraqis have erased files, you're going to reconstruct these files. Linguists, you will look over their shoulders and read the documents as they come up. Scientists, you will evaluate what the linguists are saying and determine whether or not it falls under the mandate given to the Special Commission by the Security Council. A simple task. Except I also have to tell them, as we drive to the site, the Iraqis are going to attempt to run your vehicle off the road. So I have to train you on defensive driving techniques. When we arrive at the site, people are going to come up with guns and point them at you and scream. Now, if you panic at that point in time, we lose unit cohesiveness. The inspection is over, finished, the Iraqis have won. So what I tell them is, look, the Iraqis are to fear like sharks are to blood. If you show fear in front of the Iraqis, they will capitalize upon it. They will go into a fear-feeding frenzy, and they will start intimidating you. And the second they do that, they've won the game. Our inspection, for all sense and purposes, is finished. Don't worry about what the Iraqis are doing. Worry about me. I'm your boss. I'm your leader. I'm the alpha dog. When we go in there, the Iraqis are going to be sniffing us around like dogs sniff one another, seeking to find out who the alpha dog is. They're going to raise their tail up. They're going to say, we're the toughest dog on the block. You don't worry about raising your tail. Look at me. My tail is going to be higher. They growl at me. I'm growling back. They snap at me. I'm putting them on the floor. Why? Because I'm there on behalf of the Security Council. I'm there to do the job. I will ensure that I'm the one dominating the scene. When we go in to carry out an inspection, I want the Iraqis to know that they have been inspected. We are not a group of meek scientists. We are United Nations weapons inspectors looking for weapons that Iraq is not allowed to have, weapons that they have decided to hide, and we will find them. We will not let them intimidate us.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Ritter. He's a former chief inspector for UNSCUM. He was the head of UNSCUM's Concealment Investigations Unit. This was the unit that was determined to find the weapons and weapons programs that the Iraqis had concealed after the Gulf War. He's written a new book called Endgame, Solving the Iraq Problem Once and for All. Now, as you mentioned before, the Iraqis had a concealment program. They didn't have their weapons at official weapons sites. They moved around their weapons in a way similar to the way they moved around Saddam Hussein to keep him hidden and out of harm's way. Would you tell us a little bit about their approach to concealing the weapons, how that program worked?
Well, it wasn't the world's most sophisticated program. This is not a program that was run by scientists. In fact, as we learned more and more about how they hid the weapons that they were trying to retain, or actually retaining, it became evident that through the process of hiding these weapons, they were actually destroying these weapons. Some of these are very sensitive technologies that aren't given to being thrown into the back of a truck and driven around dirt roads, bouncing around, getting dirty, staying out in the weather. This is not the most sophisticated approach towards concealing, but it's an approach that works. These guys set up safe houses around the country. These are locations that are farms, they're villas, they're homes. They're all owned or operated by family members. So this isn't just a professional concealment activity. This is a family business based upon loyalty to Saddam Hussein. And as I said, these are the same people who protect Saddam Hussein. So for one day, they might be tasked with organizing a convoy that will move the president from Site A to Site B. The next day, they'll be tasked to protect a convoy containing weapons of mass destruction material that's moving from Site D to Site E. we had to investigate the entire scope of this protection apparatus. Now, we tried it using conventional inspection approaches, on-site inspections, and flying aircraft over Iraq taking high-resolution photographs. But that by itself was not enough. And in the end, it was decided that we would have to undertake extraordinary measures to gain access to this information. These are measures that are normally one would associate with terms such as spying or espionage. But it's not spying or espionage as long as it's controlled by the United Nations for the purpose of furthering the mandate of the Security Council, that is, to find weapons of mass destruction.
You actually relied on espionage services to get some of that information. You went to the Israeli intelligence.
Well, let's back up just a second and remember what's starting all this is the fact that Iraq has to turn over weapons of mass destruction material and information, and they're not doing this. Now UNSCOM is charged by the Security Council with getting this information. We can't just pick up a phone book and dial the number for the United Nations Intelligence Service. There is none. There is no standard operating procedure on how to organize an international activity like UNSCOM to collect sensitive information that's being protected by a sovereign nation, Iraq. We had every right to go to United Nations member states for help and assistance. We are, after all, a United Nations activity. And as long as the focus of our effort was finding these weapons of mass destruction, we pretty much had free rein to do what we wanted as long as it was approved by my boss, either Rolf Ekéus, the first executive chairman of the Special Commission from Sweden, or after July of 1997, Richard Butler, the executive chairman from Australia. If they approved it, and if what we were doing was in full compliance with the mandate given to us by the Security Council, we were authorized to carry out this activity. We did go to Israel. We did go to the United States. We did go to England. We went to any number of countries and their intelligence services for help. We needed this help to get this job done. But as long as we were in control, as long as we were ensuring that what was being done was to further our disarmament activity, it's not spying. It's inspections by other means.
Tell us about the deal that you made with Israeli intelligence. I think UNSCOM had an American U-2 spy plane, but you needed help in translating the information that you got through the photos that the spy plane took. So you went to Israeli intelligence, and what was the offer you made them?
Well, let's get our terminology right. We call it a high-altitude surveillance aircraft, not a spy plane, because we don't carry out spying. That's semantics, but it's important. We had a U-2 aircraft that since August of 1991 was carrying out mandated surveillance activities over Iraq. The process was that this airplane was owned and operated by the United States Air Force, and the film would be processed by the United States government, prints would be made, and then the U.S. government would provide teams of experts who would come to New York and brief us on the results of each mission. We would tell the airplane where we wanted it to fly, what sites in Iraq we wanted it to take pictures of, and then they would come and fill us in on what was found. Now, this is okay if you want to evaluate a specific point on the ground. But the problem comes with the concealment mechanism and investigating the process that Iraq uses to hide weapons. You have to take a much broader spectrum of analysis. It's not just assessing a point on the ground. You have to assess it, what's happening around that point during a specific given period of time. This required a change in the way the airplane flew. Now, instead of just flying over a specific spot taking one picture, I had the airplane fly a figure eight over a spot and take continuous rolls of film for 2 hours so that I could develop what was happening in an area over a specific lengthy period of time. This means that the quality of analysis that has to take place is much more significant. A lot more time has to go into it.
And the United States wouldn't do that for you?
The United States was not willing to devote the resources required to do this effectively, and in fact resisted every effort by the Special Commission to carry out this kind of activity. Now, I went to my boss, then Ambassador Rolf Ekéus, the Swedish executive chairman, and told him that if he wanted me to effectively investigate how Iraq was hiding weapons, we needed to more adequately assess this imagery, this film. The U.S. wasn't willing to do it. The Israelis were. The Israelis have some of the best photo interpreters the world has ever seen. They are true experts on Iraq. And Israel was willing to dedicate the time and resources required to do this job right. Rolf Ekéus, the Swedish ambassador, and my boss agreed that this was the right approach, but he also said that we can't do this unless the United States government approves. It is, after all, their technology and their secrets that we would be taking over to Israel. We met with the U.S. government, and we obtained their approval. And so in July of 1995, I started traveling to Israel with U2 Film to spend weeks at a time with their experts to look at this imagery, determine what it meant, and also to take what we were finding from the imagery and get backup analysis, backup information from the totality of Israel's considerable intelligence capabilities. It's safe to say that without the assistance of Israel, the Special Commission would not have been able to carry out any meaningful inspection activity during the years, the latter part of 1995, all through 1996, and most of 1997. It was Israeli information that fueled the UNSCOM inspection engine, and I'm eternally grateful to Israel for that.
So what you got out of this arrangement with Israel was interpretation of the photos. What Israel got out of it is they got to see the photos and add that to the information that they had collected on Iraq.
Well, no. What Israel got out of this was knowledge that Israel made a decision that it is in their best national security interest to make UNSCOM effective. To have a United Nations inspection process that's not achieving its goal of disarming Iraq is bad for Israel. What Israel wanted was for us to find these weapons. And so what Israel got out of assisting us was knowledge that the Special Commission was more effective and able to carry out its job. Yes, I'm not going to be naive and you know, think that there wasn't double dipping, that in helping us become more effective, the Israelis were not likewise gathering more information about Iraq. That, of course, was happening. But the primary concern of Israel was not to pervert the United Nations inspection process for their own unilateral gain. It was to make the United Nations inspection process effective.
Now, you were later investigated by the United States, who was wondering if you were an Israeli spy.
Well, that's I wouldn't say later. It's ongoing as we speak. It started in...
They're still investigating you?
Absolutely. But it's become a political issue now. It's one of intimidation in an effort to prevent me from speaking out on the failures of American foreign policy. The fact of the matter is, everything I did with Israel, in Israel, was not only approved by my United Nations boss, Rolf Ekéus, and later Richard Butler, but was also known to and approved by the United States government. Then furthermore, we come to the issue of, you know, classified information. I was not a U.S. government employee with a security clearance. My relationship with the United States government was an unclassified relationship. My work at the United Nations, while sensitive, was not a classified job from the United States perspective. There is no way I could have turned over American secrets to Israel. Everything that Israel gained from the Scott Ritter cooperation was information that was approved for release to Israel by my boss, and also known to and approved by the United States government.
So your point about intelligence is that this isn't a case where there are official weapon sites that you could just walk in and inspect. The weapons are being shipped around and hidden. There's an elaborate concealment program, and without intelligence, you'd be helpless to find where the weapons really were.
I couldn't have said it better myself. There is a role for inspectors going to known sites. We have to monitor sites that were affiliated with Iraqi prohibited programs in the past to make sure that they aren't reconstituting their capabilities. There are also sites called dual capable sites. sites that are currently involved in production of civilian goods or non-prohibited goods, but which could be converted for use in prescribed areas, prohibited areas. Those also have to be visited. Those are the roles that other inspectors did, very important jobs. My job was to find the hidden weapons, and that's a completely different process.
Now, it turns out that the United States had spies on your UNSCUM team for a while. How long, when were the spies there? How long were they there? How many of them were there?
Well, again, let's be careful with our terminology. A spy would be somebody who was on the team without the knowledge of the United Nations carrying out work on behalf of the United States, not the United Nations. As I think we've made clear, and you said very, very wisely, we have a very difficult job and we would be helpless unless we received intelligence support from member states. Intelligence support goes beyond just the provision of analysis and analysts to look at data. We actually need assistance in-country in collecting information. And we relied on the support of the United States and other governments to provide us with intelligence personnel who would serve as inspection team members. Now, the Iraqis may call these people spies, but they were not. They were United Nations weapons inspectors. They were brought in because they had a specific skill that the weapons inspection team needed.
So you're saying when these guys were on your team, they weren't representing the CIA, although they were CIA agents. When they were on your team, they were representing UNSCUM.
When they were on my team, they worked for me. And I guarantee you I would have fired them in a heartbeat, and I have fired people for improper behavior. I was in control. I was the alpha dog, and people did what I told them to do. And that's the promise that I gave Rolf Achaeus. That's the promise I gave Richard Butler. There will be no improper activity on a team that I lead. That's my guarantee.
What would be improper activity? I mean, if a CIA agent working for UNSCUM on your team got information and reported it back to the CIA, would that be improper?
Okay, but now you're talking about the reality of the United Nations process. I cannot control what happens once a person is released back to their government. No one can control that. I can control what that man does in country, or man or woman. I can control what activity they do and how they handle information and how they behave while they're doing an inspection. Once they take off their blue hat and go back to Washington, D.C., London, Paris, Moscow, they're out of my control. They're no longer United Nations inspectors, and if they report to their governments, then it's incumbent upon that government to be protective of the United Nations process. While they may be privy to data that we don't want them to be privy to, that's a reality of life. That's a reality of working in the United Nations system. The key is that they don't do anything with that information that would compromise the character, the independent, objective nature of the work of the Special Commission. Now, almost every government was respectful of that. It was only the United States that didn't know how to draw the line properly.
What do you mean about drawing the line?
Well, as I said, our job was to find how Iraq hid these weapons. The same people that hid these weapons were the people that were protecting Saddam Hussein. They used the same techniques, the same methodologies, the same communication systems. Now, we penetrated them for the purpose of finding how they hid weapons, but we collected a heck of a lot of information on how they protected the president of Iraq. The United States, especially the Clinton administration in the last few years, lost focus of what the world wanted when they put the weapons inspectors in Iraq. It was about disarmament, only disarmament. But the United States had undertaken a policy of regime removal. In fact, Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, said in March of 1997, it doesn't matter if Saddam Hussein complies with his disarmament obligations, we will continue economic sanctions until Saddam Hussein is removed from power. The U.S. became focused on getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And when the United Nations weapons inspection process started uncovering invaluable information on the protection of Saddam Hussein, it became more important for the United States government to take control of this activity for the purpose of removing Saddam Hussein than allowing the inspection process to proceed towards the disarmament of Iraq. That's how they perverted the process.
So you're saying that the United States wanted this information to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and at the same time, they restricted your ability as an UNSCOM inspector?
Absolutely.
How did they restrict your ability?
Well, let's talk about it on two levels. One, we have the information collection process. One of the things that I did in Iraq was to set up a covert communications intercept capability to monitor the communications of Saddam Hussein and his inner circle on how they move these weapons around. This is very sensitive and, in the end, very successful. In fact, by March of 1998, the effort that I was in charge of was acknowledged by many in the United States intelligence community as being the most significant intelligence breakthrough since the end of the Cold War. It was that good, that important. But it was important to them, not because of what it told about how Iraq was hiding weapons, but rather what it said about how Iraq protected the president of Saddam Hussein. So what did the U.S. do? They put pressure on Richard Butler, the Australian executive chairman, to shut down my operation, withdraw my people, remove the equipment. We no longer were carrying out this activity. And they replaced it with their own device operating totally under their control. Now, they promised Richard Butler that he would gain information about how Iraq moved weapons of mass destruction, but Richard Butler had no way of knowing what they were collecting and what they were doing with this information. He had lost his ability to influence when he agreed to have me and my team removed from the problem. So now the United States had succeeded in using the United Nations as a cover for the collection of intelligence information for their own unilateral gain, not for the gain of the United Nations. That's one way. The other way was through the inspection process itself. When I became equipped with this highly sensitive and very accurate information, I would go to Richard Butler or Rolf Acacius before him and design an inspection to find these weapons that were being hidden. Now, because we had high-quality information and because we were going to sites that were generally associated with the protection of Saddam Hussein, these inspections would be very confrontational. The Iraqis would obstruct our work. In obstructing our work, they would also confront the Security Council with the need to either ignore Iraqi obstruction or to hold Iraq accountable. And in the end, the United States realized that this was a very difficult prospect of holding Iraq accountable. And instead of coming up with a political solution, the decision was, we will hold back the weapons inspectors. We won't let them go out and find these weapons, because when they try and find these weapons, the Iraqis stand up, and we don't know what to do when the Iraqis stand up. We don't know how to respond when they confront. We would rather have the United Nations continue to submit vaguely worded reports about Iraqi noncompliance so that we can justify the continuation of economic sanctions rather than letting the weapons inspectors go in and try and find these weapons. So that's the other way they obstructed our work.
If what you're saying is true, that once the United States had CIA agents working as weapons inspectors, they wanted to use that information to find out Saddam Hussein's whereabouts and his hiding policies so that they could overthrow him, and that finally sabotaged your work, couldn't you make the argument that this is just like one typical example of what goes wrong when there are intelligence agents operating on a UN team?
Well, there's no doubt of that this is a prime example of what can go wrong if you don't control these personnel. Understand that.
But you yourself said that you couldn't control them, that you could maybe control their behavior while they're on the team, but as soon as they left the team, you had no control.
Well, it's not just intelligence personnel. What happens if you put, foreign service officers on it? When you have a process, we're presented with one of the ultimate quandaries. On the one hand, we're trying to put together a team where we need governments to provide experts. They'll loan them to us. Now, the mere fact that we're being given these personnel on loan means that we can't control them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But we are getting the best qualified personnel in the world to solve this problem. So, but on the other hand, you say, well, why don't you just create a permanent United Nations inspectorate of United Nations employees? Now, I'll tell you the reality of the UN system. The quality of the personnel will be significantly less. They will not be the world's top experts. Furthermore, if you're naive enough to believe that intelligence services do not recruit United Nations personnel, then you've got a problem. Intelligence is a reality that we have to live with. What I'm saying is the best way to deal with that is to be in control of the situation while you're in country, while we're carrying out our tasks. And, that's what we succeeded in doing until the very end when Richard Butler, unfortunately, turned over control of a very sensitive aspect of our operations to the United States.
Now, when you would show up to inspect weapons or inspect, you know, concealed weapons components, you said that Saddam Hussein's people, his agents or guards or secret agents, whatever, would portray the UN agents as international espionage agents. And that stood in your way, and you had to convince them, no, you're not spies, you're UN weapons inspectors. But the fact is that there were people who were from intelligence agencies who were in the weapons inspection program, and doesn't that give some credibility to Saddam Hussein's people who say, we don't want you here because the information is going to end up in the hands of spies?
Well, there is some credence to that, but again, our job was to find weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein and his cronies were hiding. Let's make sure we put the horse before the cart here, not the cart before the horse. We wouldn't be at these sites carrying out these activities if Iraq had fully cooperated. Iraq is the one who confronted the world with the challenge of how to deal with this massive obstructionism, how to deal with this concealment mechanism. The world chose to react by creating a unique capability to find these weapons, to find how Iraq hid them. There is no United Nations intelligence service that we could turn to help.
I understand, but what kind of precedent does it set for future weapons inspections? I mean, what you're saying here is that there were agents from the CIA who were working as weapons inspectors, and the information they got about the weapons concealment program when they left your team was used as information about the Saddam Hussein concealment program, and that information was used in an attempt to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. So what about the next UN weapons inspection team? I mean, why wouldn't the dictator of the country that's being inspected think, I can't let these guys in because it's going to lead to, you know, my assassination or overthrow. This is what the information is really going to go toward.
Oh, I'm totally on your side on this one. Look, don't blame the CIA. I mean, there's a tendency around the country and around the world.
No, but weren't you one of the people
who Clinton
approved
administration?
It? No, well, but didn't you and other UN people approve their presence?
Of course we did. We had to. What other options did we have? We had to find these weapons. We had to find this information that Iraq is not allowed to have. There's a Security Council resolution that says this is prohibited. Iraq was hiding it. And then the world turns to us and says, find it. Now, I challenge you and anybody else to find me a book, a guidebook on how to find hidden weapons in Iraq. There is none. We were charged with finding these weapons, and we had to find them quick. And we had to turn to the people in the world who are equipped to deal with this problem. And those happen to come from the intelligence and security services of member states.
But it sounds like the solution led to an even larger problem.
Well, the solution led to a larger problem because the United States, remember, we didn't have a problem with Israel. We didn't have a problem with the United Kingdom. We didn't have a problem with France. We didn't have a problem with any other nation that was involved in a sensitive relationship with the Special Commission other than the United States. And the reason is, it was the United States national security team of the Clinton administration that made a policy decision to pervert the work of the Special Commission for their own narrow unilateral objectives. The CIA didn't make that policy. The CIA does not formulate policy. The CIA was an implementer of policy, and the policy was made by Madeleine Albright, by Sandy Berger, and by others in the national security team, which put removal of Saddam Hussein ahead of internationally mandated disarmament inspections. That's where the problem lay. And now we're confronted with the situation that, thanks to the short-sighted policy of the United States, the weapons inspection process, international weapons inspection process, has probably been forever tarnished. And you're absolutely correct. There is almost no way you are going to be able to view future United Nations weapons inspection teams as being independent, credible implementers of international will. They will always forever carry the stigma of being a tool of intelligence services.
You resigned in August of last year. Why did you resign?
Well, largely for what we just discussed. I was hired to do a job. That job was to find weapons of mass destruction. And I tried to do that job. And in the end, the United States was obstructing my work, not letting me carry out this disarmament activity, was perverting a cause which I believed in, and I could not be a part of that.
What do you think is left of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction?
Well, the fact of the matter is when we started in 1991, there were massive programs. But by 1998, we had, in effect, disarmed Iraq. There were no more chemical weapons factories, biological weapons factories, nuclear weapons factories, or long-range ballistic missile factories.
Was that because of bombing or because of your inspections?
No, it was because of the inspection process. We were tremendously successful at what we did. Now, it took time. But in the end, we were able to uncover the bulk of what Iraq was doing and, in fact, supervise its destruction. What was left were these components, the blueprints, the designs, what I call seed stock, what Iraq can use to rebuild a weapons capability. But these, rather than being configured in the form of factories, were stuck in the back of cars being hidden around Iraq as the weapons inspectors hunted them down. That was what was left of the disarmament process. And, we didn't get to it. But today, Iraq is effectively disarmed. The problem is, thanks to Desert Fox and the bombing campaign of December, there are no more inspectors in Iraq making sure Iraq doesn't reconstitute its weapons capabilities.
Do you think it would have the money to do that?
The Iraq is generating hundreds of millions of dollars of income every year through sanctions violations. Saddam Hussein is enriching his own pockets, building lavish palaces, and funding covert procurement activity. Part of the job I had was not just hunting down weapons in Iraq, but also working with other governments to interdict weapons that Iraq was trying to procure abroad. We had tremendous success. We interdicted a shipment of ballistic missile guidance and control components in Jordan in November 1995. And we stopped a shipment of ballistic missile equipment coming out of Romania in 1998. But that was funded by Saddam Hussein today, despite sanctions.
You've been very outspoken on the issue of how American intelligence handled its presence on UNSCOM. Do you feel like you're compromising American security in any way?
Well, absolutely not. I've been very careful about not releasing any information on American intelligence activity. Everything I've talked about is what the special commission was doing and how that was perverted. I've also spoken out about the policy behind this perversion and the failure of this administration to define an effective policy for handling the Iraq situation, for lacking an end-game strategy on how to get out of Iraq. Some of those issues are addressed in the book. By speaking out, I feel that I'm, fulfilling my obligation as an American citizen to hold my elected government accountable for its failures, and also my duty as an American to help educate my fellow Americans on the difficult problem in Iraq, and the realities of Iraq, and why our policies are failing, and maybe what we need to do differently to get ourselves out of this quagmire.
Well, Scott Ritter, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Ritter is a former chief inspector for UNSCOM. His new book is called Endgame. We called the State Department, but they declined to comment on Scott Ritter or his allegations about the Clinton administration. The UN is discussing if it should try to resume weapons inspections in Iraq.